From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. The New Hampshire House kills the school voucher bill again. Lawmakers agree to hash out their differences on animal cruelty legislation. Local politicians react to President Trump's decision to pull out of the Iran nuclear deal, and the Disability Rights Center accuses the Sununu Youth Services Center of using unlawful restraint. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we will talk about them this hour. And you can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. That's all one word, NHPR Exchange. And we are also streaming a live video of this radio broadcast, and you can check that out on the Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Trent Spinner of the Union Leader, and political reporter Paul Steinhauser. Thank you very much for being here.
Great to be here.
Hi, Peter.
Again, listeners, the phone number for you to call to join the conversation, 1-800-892-6477. And we're going to start with the big international news, foreign policy news this week, that President Trump pulled the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal. Not entirely surprising that he did it. It was a campaign promise. The response from Democrats has here in New Hampshire has mostly lined up what Democrats on the national stage have been saying. Democratic Representative Carol Shea Porter says Iran is a threat, needs to be monitored, and the Iran nuclear deal was doing that.
And so for us to unilaterally pull out, we've walked away from our allies here. I think it makes us look bad on the world stage.
Makes us look bad on the world stage. Paul, that's the common line from Democrats.
All four Democrats in our delegation, which is a four-person delegation, a chorus of criticism of the president's move. I thought the most telling one was Senator Jeanne Shaheen. Of course, she is our senior member of the delegation. She sits on the Armed Services and the Foreign Relations Committee. She called it the follow-through of a reckless campaign promise. And she said, like Shea Porter did right there, that by getting out of the treaty, it basically takes away our only effective means of curtailing Iran's nuclear capabilities, and also kind of incites them to now go a little more hard line. I don't think anybody's surprised by the decisions there or the announcements by our delegation.
Yeah, President Trump has shown a general distaste for multilateral agreements, anything where the U.S. is one of a number of countries involved in the agreement. He prefers to talk about bilateral negotiations, and, you know, he's talked at length over the last few years about what a great deal maker he is. And so the question is whether there is some other deal to be had here. The consensus in the diplomatic community was that this was probably the best possible deal you could get at the moment. It was not perfect, but it was moving in the right direction. There are a number of Republicans, in fairness to President Trump, who are quite happy that he's pulled out. They consider Iran to be a bad actor, and that that this particular agreement was not sufficient for preventing nuclear proliferation. So, you know, we'll see what comes next. The big question that I hear from most analysts and most diplomats is, does President Trump have a plan B? And, you know, this is another campaign promise that he made continually during the campaign in 2016. And so he's fulfilling that promise, as Paul said. Jeanne Shaheen called it a reckless campaign promise. So we're all waiting to see what the plan B is. You know, right now, they're a little preoccupied with negotiations with North Korea. But we'll see whether there is some tougher bilateral type of agreement to be reached. It's not clear to me that that's the case. And we'll see how our allies, whether they're able to step in and fill the void left by us pulling out.
Trent? It was interesting to see this week. It was giving me flashbacks from the 2016 campaign. Even here in New Hampshire, this was one of his biggest applause lines at rallies. People loved when he talked about pulling out of the Iran deal. They really thought that this was a mistake. Republican supporters of Trump thought that this was a mistake. And people would cheer wildly. I remember there was one rally in Laconia at a school, or that was almost the biggest applause line. And what's interesting to see is that people are kind of surprised that this happened. I mean, he's been saying that he was going to do this. I think that he was being pressured. I think people were upset that he hadn't done it yet. There were a couple of opportunities to pull out earlier, and he didn't. So this has been a major issue for his base, including here in New Hampshire. And I think what we've seen is people are, like, kind of like Dean was saying, people are supportive of it. The party chairwoman here said that he's a deal maker and he sees a bad deal and he pulled out of it. So I think we'll see what happens. But I think there's a lot of support among his base.
Paul?
And his base will get to cheer again in just 3 days when the U.S. Embassy has moved from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, something else he promised on the campaign trail, which he is now following through with. Again, critics say, look at the consequences.
Other GOP news to cover this week is that the GOP announced it's closing two of its big party meetings coming up, one tomorrow and then one on Monday, the Spring to Victory fundraiser. Dean, these meetings were closed last year, but historically speaking, they're not typically closed to the media.
That's right. This is a fairly recent development for the New Hampshire GOP. I believe the Democratic meetings are still open at this point.
They are.
The state convention and the annual dinner that they have. Yeah, you know, this is kind of a reaction to the sort of toxic climate between President Trump and the media. I think it's trickling down now to the state level. Republicans feeling like they can't get a fair shake. They can't get get good coverage. The dinner that's coming up, the Spring to Victory fundraiser with Education Secretary Betsy DeVos coming here. She's been a controversial figure. We just had the voucher school voucher bill killed in the House again for I think the third time, and so she is not someone who has garnered very very good coverage in her travels around the country. So I think this is kind of a preemptive way of forestalling that. But it does, you know, it's a private organization. They can do whatever they want. It doesn't look particularly good, but you have to understand it in the context of the current relationship between some parts of the GOP and the media.
And it gives the Democrats in the state, Ray Buckley and his state Democratic Party, just another, piece of ammunition to attack the Republicans.
Yeah, he was saying that this was sort of dictated by the White House, right? But actually, the spokesman for the Republican Party says this was a mutually agreed upon solution, the White House and local GOP members saying no media. Trent?
You know, what I don't understand about this, I've covered these before, and with all due respect to everyone who participates on both sides, the Democratic one and the Republican one, they can be a little tedious. And so I think it's important that just as a straight up matter of public service, that the media is there, is able to cover these events and report back to everyone else who maybe can't spend their entire Saturday talking about Republican Party or Democratic Party platform issues, that there's some kind of understanding of here's what the party is looking at. Here's what our leadership is talking about. And I just I don't understand how they're going to go from having this meeting and then communicating that back out to everyone in the party. Not everyone is on Facebook. Not everyone is on Twitter and will see whatever the party posts. Not everyone is on their email list. I think that a lot of people rely on the media to just kind of tell the basic story of here are the facts of what happened. On the local level, I mean, I understand that there's this whole tension on the national level with President Trump and the national media. On the local level, I think that overall, the media gets along very well with the local parties. I hear very few complaints about, fake news on the local level or unfair coverage of this type of event. So it is a new thing that the party's trying. Don't forget there's new leadership. Jeannie Forrester's now in charge. They have a new communications person, Pat Hines, and they have just kind of changed it up. It's different, and I just wonder what that's going to mean for the public.
Well, Trent, last year at the dinner when it was closed, we had that kerfuffle over the reporter who got an invitation in and characterized Kellyanne Conway's comments in a particular way and sort of downplayed the size of the turnout, and that caused a whole multi-day debate over media coverage. So this is kind of a continuation of that.
But to follow up on Trent's point, though, you know, there won't be any media coverage. So the only media coverage this weekend will be of the Democratic presidential possible contenders for 2020. You're not going to be able to read anywhere in the Union Leader, Concord Monitor, wherever, about what happened here. And it's going to be a lost opportunity for the state party, Republican state party, to get their message out.
Nothing from the inside, anyway. Maybe someone will be outside.
Maybe.
Well, that's the other thing, too, is that everyone who's in this meeting then just calls us. And so rather than the reporter being there and just being able to get the facts, what happens is people just leak their version of what happens. And then there's a dispute. Well, did this? Who really said that? Who? We're going to get a story like that. There are going to be hundreds of people talking about issues. Of course, but they're going to call us. There are going to be leaks. There are going to be people talking about it. So we're going to have a story. It's just not going to be the same story if a reporter was allowed inside.
And this is a fundraising event. So is there an effect on turnout for a fundraising event? whether or not the media is going to be there? I mean, do donors care if the media is going to be there and possibly see them and see who's attending?
They sold out. You know, they just sold out. I don't think it affects the fundraising. The Democratic, their big dinner was last month. They sold out as well. The media was there. We were there. I don't think it has an impact.
No impact. All right. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Coming up on the show, as a bill that merges the definitions of domicile and residency for voting purposes advances, the governor is calling for the state Supreme Court to review it and a similar bill. What do you make of this? Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Give us a call now so we can bring you into the conversation when it starts. Again, 1-800-892-6477. You can also send in your question or comment by email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Also this week, Senator Maggie Hassan went to the U.S.-Mexico border to get a sense of what is needed to stop the flow of drugs. Trent, what did she reportedly take away from the experience?
Senator Hassan spent 5 days on the U.S.-Mexico border. It's a long time. This was an official trip, and she spent a lot of time with DEA agents, Homeland Security agents. And her takeaway was, we need more technology down there. We need more ability, there are these machines that can detect illegal drugs coming into the country. We need more of that. We need more infrastructure. Just the border is incredibly rugged, and we need more infrastructure for agents to be able to get to places where illegal immigrants are coming in.
Like roads.
Roads,
yeah.
Right. Just being able to physically get to places where they need to be. What she did not think we needed was any more was a bigger wall. She says that she heard from a number of people down there who said that the wall will not help. They don't want it. They're looking for infrastructure. They're looking for more technology. They're looking for more people.
Paul?
Yeah, not an entire wall. She's been clear about that. And most Democrats don't support the president's push to build an entire wall along the U.S.-Mexican border. But she did say that in some situations, there may need to be some kind of physical barriers. And that's kind of the way that's what piqued my interest. That's what I led with my article for The Monitor, because you're trying to have it maybe both ways. In some areas, a physical barrier is okay, but not an entire wall. It's a tricky situation. Plus, you know, a lot of Democrats want to keep the drugs out, but allow the immigrants in. That's not the case with some Republicans.
And the reality is that the money to build the wall at the level that President Trump wants, it's just not there at this point. And, you know, we've been talking for a couple of years now about whether or not he can actually get Mexico to pay for it. There's a whole drama going on about how the White House portrays progress on this issue to its base. President Trump and others have talked about the construction is underway, but that construction is actually repairs of walls that were already scheduled to be repaired at an earlier date. So it's not new construction. And we had this other story where he just recently berated the head of Homeland Security because there's been an uptick in border crossings. So this is an active issue for him. He still talks about the wall, but the reality is most experts and people who focus on this say that the issue is there's technology, there are other ways you can do this instead of building a physical wall across the entire southern border.
We should probably point out one of the reasons she went on this trip is Hassan sits on the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee, so she's got oversight into a lot of this stuff that happens. Of course, it is the top issue, drugs, the drug crisis in our state, too. So it's definitely a marriage there.
Mm-hmm. pardon me. Also this week, Senator Jean Shaheen went to bat for a group of Indonesians living on the seacoast. These people were here lawfully. Some of their children are American citizens, but recently they were notified they would be deported. Paul, what did Senator Shaheen try to accomplish with respect to these Indonesians?
So these Indonesians have been living here, like you said, for 25, 30 years. She has been trying to work with ICE. They've been notified that they're going to be deported. They had been receiving extensions, 6 months or 1 year, for a long period of time. And she's basically trying to make sure that they get another extension, that they don't have to leave. Some of them have adult children here. Some of them have businesses here. And she thinks it's unfair that they have to leave the country after all these years.
And the argument is also that the circumstances under which they came here, the sort of religious persecution, that hasn't significantly changed, and there's still fear for their lives should they be sent back to Indonesia.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. Give us a call with your questions or comments about the week's news. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And we're broadcasting live video of this radio show as well, so you can check that out on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. Thanks very much for tuning in on the video. That's really nice. Senator Shaheen also introduced a bill that would authorize 4,000 additional visas for Afghans who supported the U.S. mission in Afghanistan. What's her rationale for this, Trent?
This is a compelling story. These are people who fought alongside U.S. service members in Afghanistan, who served as translators, who helped coordinate logistics, and who are now known in their communities back in Afghanistan as people who support the United States, which can create security issues for them. It can create safety issues for their family, for their families. And what Senator Shaheen has been trying to do every year now for quite some time is get thousands of them visas to come to the United States where they can live safely. And, you know, in her opinion, if they fought alongside U.S. troops, if they helped support the United States effort in Afghanistan, the least we could do is bring them here. There has been a considerable fight in D.C. about the number of people. She's talking this year about 4,000 visas. And there's a dispute in Washington, I think, of just about how many people from Afghanistan can come here, what the qualifications would be, what exactly you did alongside U.S. service members. But she's looking for 4,000 visas for this year.
Hmm. Final story about Senator Jean Shaheen is that she was talking with Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristen Nielsen about temporary visas for seasonal workers. Apparently there's a big need for that here in New Hampshire. Let's hear what she had to say.
What can I tell these businesses who are desperately calling to say, what are we going to do about workers? Because we don't know what the government's going to do.
We don't know what the government's going to do. Or do we now, Trent?
We don't know. And this is a big issue, right? There are a lot of ski areas here. There are a lot of hotels here. And they use these visas, these guest worker visas, for jobs that many people – these are jobs that maybe high school kids used to do back in the day, that just the economics just don't work for that anymore. And so, you know, we have a huge tourist industry in New Hampshire. It's the biggest industry here. And so – to kind of make that all run, you need these guest worker visas, according to, you know, business owners. And so she's fighting for, and a number of other people in the state are also fighting to increase the number, because it's hard to run businesses if you don't have the people that you need to do it.
Mm-hmm. And put this in context for us. Is this a fight that happens every year?
This is a fight that happens all the time and will continue to fight. The counter argument is that these guest workers are taking away jobs from Americans, from high school students, from people who need them. But these are temporary jobs, many of them without benefits. Really, you can't survive on them if you have a family. Many of these workers are they get subsidized housing through their work, or they get free food. I mean, think about working at a ski area, right? I mean, you couldn't really live your life as a lift operator, because it's only, you know, part-time. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I mean, there's a debate about this every year. I think that we will get some more of these visas.
And Paul, really
and you
quick.
Factor in that the state has one of the lowest state unemployment rates in the nation. So that's why it's so important.
Also another factor, right. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. We're speaking with Dean Spiliotis of SNHU, Trent Spinner of the Union Leader and political reporter Paul Steinhauser. And with you, we hope, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Coming up after the break, we're going to discuss legislation for the school voucher program. Died its third death in the New Hampshire legislature. We'll talk about how it went down. Talk about Medicaid expansion. That's moving forward. The controversial voting law that would merge the definitions of domicile and residency. It's going to be analyzed by the state Supreme Court, perhaps. What do you think? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and the author of the website NH Political Capital, political reporter Paul Steinhauser, and Trent Spinner of The Union Leader. Give us a call if you have questions or comments about the week's news. We're going to be talking about legislative matters for the next 20 minutes or so. You can weigh in, 1-800-892-6477. And one of the big ones this week was school vouchers. So last week on this program, we learned that this twice-killed bill, at the time twice-killed, would allow some students to use public money to attend private schools to be homeschooled. It would be revisited. The thought was that legislators didn't show up in enough numbers to get it through, so they weren't going to try again for the third time. But I guess it didn't work out this third time around, Paul.
Shot down. I said three strikes and you're out, right? So it is out now for this session this year. Maybe it can come back next year, but it is done. What happened was last Thursday, a week ago, the state Senate, which had passed this bill originally, it's called SB 193, Senate Bill 193, they tacked it onto a different education bill, passed it and sent it back to the House, which dealt with it this week. There were, I believe, three votes. I wasn't in the chamber at the time, but I was following Dave Solomon, who was tweeting it out from the union leader. Good man, great reporter. And there were three separate votes, all narrowly went down. This bill would have allowed some parents in the state to take their children out of public school, send them to private or parochial school, but use that taxpayer money to do that. Obviously supported by the governor, a big champion of this bill, supported by school choice advocates, supported by a lot of Republicans, opposed by Democrats and the unions who said this would really weaken the public school system. It's a bitter defeat for the governor. When he was on the campaign trail back in 2015 and 2016, this is what he pushed for. He talked about it in his State of the State address earlier this year. I think it's also a sign of the weak Republican House Republican leadership. They could not get this bill passed, even though it sailed through the Senate. A lot of Republicans opposed it in the House, including Neil Kirk, the top Republican on the Finance Committee, the powerful chairman there, who said, listen, this is going to mean a lot of costs are going to be downshifted to local school districts. It could raise your property taxes. That was some of the opposition. But also, as you said, lawmakers aren't showing up. There were only 330 people in the House last week, 350 this week. That hurts the majority party. That's the votes weren't there because lawmakers weren't showing up. Trent?
And that is the numbers are what matter here.
Yeah.
This vote went down by this bill went down by 5 votes. There are about 390 people seated in the House right now. 60 of them did not show up. Most of them Republicans. If they had 6 more votes, if they had 10% more, if 10% more of those people showed up to vote, this probably would have passed. And they just cannot. And this is an ongoing issue in the House. And Dave Solomon just wrote about this in the Sunday Union Leader. There has been a massive drop in attendance among especially among Republicans in the House. And that has stalled a lot of these legislative priorities. Republicans have been, I mean, this has been a major issue for Republicans for 2 years that they've been working on. And it failed by 5 votes. Same with right to work, same with all kinds of other issues. And it's just because of attendance.
I was talking to Patrick Abrami. He's a state rep from Stratum, from my neck of the woods. Republican, pretty conservative, loved the school choice bill. He was furious. He was telling me how upset he was. I was writing about it in Seacoast Online, that the numbers weren't there. He's like, why are they running for state office in the first place if they're not going to show up in the chamber for the crucial votes? And it is a good point, and attendance has dropped. It is a problem. And if the Democrats take the majority, they may have to deal with the same issue next year.
Yeah, it's one of the potential consequences of having essentially a volunteer legislature, particularly such a large body. It's essentially a collective action problem. You kind of free ride and figure, oh, I can't go today. Other people will be there to vote, even though I can't be there. And it's certainly a problem for Republicans. This is fascinating to me. There was such energy and enthusiasm behind this among school choice advocates. You know, this is an issue that has been kind of a political a hot button for decades, going all the way back to the Reagan administration. And I think there was real energy with President Trump coming in, Betsy DeVos coming in as education secretary, Republican governor and state legislature, that the time was right for this. And to see it kind of get chipped away at because of the funding issues, the inclusion of religious schools and the potential there for a court challenge, all these things, and then combined with the turnout issue, it's just remarkable to see it not actually pass now, given the excitement around it among conservative activists not that long ago.
And the likelihood next year that this is going to come up again and pass is probably much smaller, because let's be honest, the next year the Democrats may be in control, or if the Republicans retain control, they'll probably have less of a majority. The bill this was the year to get this bill passed, and it didn't happen.
Okay. Worth mentioning this week, although it's not entirely surprising, that lawmakers, they sent Medicaid expansion to the governor, says he's going to sign it. Good news for the 50,000-plus people who are on Medicaid expansion.
Surprising that, you know, when this was first discussed, Republicans had so many issues with it, and this just sailed through the Senate, through the House, and the governor's going to sign it. Really, with no major issues, right, Paul? I mean, there was no major debate on this.
There was no major debate. The Democrats had they were a little upset about a few things, but as Senate Minority Leader Jeff Woodburn said, we're not going to burn down the barn just to get a few rats out. So they had a couple of minor issues with the bill and how it was passed. But overall, you're right. Everybody, this was a bipartisan effort. This is what's right about New Hampshire, right? This was nice. This was Republicans and Democrats, the administration and lawmakers all working together. This is an important bill, as you said, Peter. 50,000 people get their health insurance through this bill. Also, a lot of money in the state for recovery and treatment efforts for the opioid epidemic come through this program. So this was an important one to pass. It may hurt the governor a little bit with some conservatives at the ballot box in November, but overall, this was definitely one worth passing.
And Republicans got the work requirement, which is something that they really
Bingo.
Like. And
Great point.
They can kind of point to that as well. You know, we'll make sure that the system is operating more fairly and people are not cheating the system or free riding by having this work requirement. So they're certainly happy about that.
Let's talk about the voting law, because that had some movement this week. There are two versions in the legislature. One of them advanced. The other one's still in play. And the governor is asking the Supreme Court to sort of review these, which does happen, though it's not terribly common. And we get an email from Andrea in Hopkinton who says, I am glad Governor Sununu is having the Supreme Court review these bills. In a rapidly aging state such as ours, keeping young, educated people here should be a priority. Voting is a great way to develop a real connection and involvement with your local community, encouraging said young adults to stay after graduation. So Andrea from Hopkinton, obviously alluding to the fact that a lot of college students, they have domicile, but they don't have residency, which comes with some other obligations, some of them financial. So perhaps worth looking into some Supreme Court and legal issues with this. Trent?
The argument that that college students can make, and I think this is what the Supreme Court is maybe going to focus on, is that you can't tax people for voting. And so what this bill would do is would say, if you're going to vote here, you have to have a driver's license here, you have to register your car here, and that could potentially cost hundreds of dollars. And so what students are saying is that equates to a poll tax. I want to vote here. In exchange, New Hampshire is going to make me pay all of these fees to do that. So that is kind of the question. Is that a poll tax? Is it not? This exists in other states, right? This is the law in many other states. And so what the Supreme Court will say on that is really up to them. I have no idea. But this is an important issue for college towns, because if you look at the numbers, right, you look at Hanover, you look at Keene, you look at Plymouth, you look at Hanover. And so if you look, I mean, there are double digit percentages of new voter registration every single cycle. And all of those towns that I just listed are huge Democratic strongholds. And so the numbers are what's going to be key here. How many of those people will say, I don't want to have to register my car here, so I'm not going to vote. I'm going to instead get a absentee ballot from my home state. That's kind of the unknown in all of this, is what percentage of people who vote in all those college towns will no longer vote, maybe will no longer vote for Democrats, and what that means for the next election.
And Trent, we know for young voters, research, they're less likely to vote. So it's not even clear that they will get an absentee ballot from their home state. They may just choose not to participate at all. And, you know, judicial review is certainly a role that courts can play. I think at the federal level, the Supreme Court is maybe 10% of what they do. So it doesn't happen all the time at the state level. But I think Governor Sununu is trying to get out ahead of the issues that you are laying out. And it also buys him a little time to figure out what he wants to do, because he's kind of stuck in between the two parties on this issue.
Yeah, I think there are some politics involved here, because going back to the 2016 campaign, this was a major issue among the Republican base. This was something that the governor himself used, including in NHPR interviews, talked about, you know,
buses and all that.
Right. And so the base wants it. He talked about it during the election. He then maybe didn't like some of the logistics here of how the bill would actually work. He's concerned. He's expressed publicly that he's concerned that it might It might stop some students from voting, which he doesn't want to happen. And so he's kind of stuck here now, right? He's on the record. The party supports it. He's concerned about the bill. So like you said, Dean, I think that the Supreme Court thing buys him a little bit of time.
The governor is definitely in a big pickle here. I spoke to him back in September after SB 3, Senate Bill 3, he had signed it into law.
That's the controversial bill that would have imposed some financial penalties.
Right. It's still being held up in the courts, but it is a law, though it's being held up. He said at the time, that's it. That was great. I'm glad where we are. We don't need anything additional. But other conservatives felt differently, and we had these two bills that have now made their way through. The governor's definitely walking a tightrope on this one because, as Dean said, and as Trent said, you know, a lot of people in the base want this to be passed. Republicans for years have railed against Democrats with, they say, you know, voter fraud here in New Hampshire. Democrats say this is an attempted voter suppression. But there's two bills, right? So the first bill, 1264, could be vetoed by the governor, but he's still hoping that maybe there will be resolution on the other bill when it goes to conference of committee.
The problem, though, Paul, is we don't know what that resolution would look like because he has said nothing about what he would want an assignable alternative to look like. He just says he's not happy with things the way they are. We've said many times that this is going to end up in the courts, so might as well do some judicial review, buy a little time, and see what they say.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We're speaking with our guests today about the week's news and still to come. Democratic gubernatorial candidate Steve Marchand unveiled his plan to create incentives for candidates for state office to raise more money through small donations. What do you make of this plan? And what do you make of Marchand's candidacy for governor overall? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, which is where you can see a live video of this radio broadcast. You can also send an email exchange at nhpr.org. A couple more things legislatively to talk about this week. Animal cruelty legislation. The House and Senate have agreed to find a compromise on controversial animal cruelty legislation. Dean, what do you make of this?
Yeah, this is going to go to a conference committee, I believe. This originally started in the Senate, I believe, with Jeb Bradley. This was a response to the Wolfboro situation with Christina Fey and the Great Danes. There was also a big problem with a large number of German shepherds at another point. So it was an attempt to put stricter controls on commercial breeding and also figuring out how to deal with the costs, which can be substantial, when an organization takes possession of dogs that have been treated badly, and who pays for that. So the original Senate bill was sort of a fairly robust attempt at tightening restrictions. The House version is much weaker. I think it removes the individuals from responsibility for paying for external care for the animals. You know, we've seen Christina Fey, she has to pay something like $800,000. The care for those Great Danes has been very expensive.
More than a million now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the concern is you get this sort of strong Senate bill, this kind of weak House bill. It's not clear yet if there is some sort of middle ground that will have any net positive effect on the situation. But we'll see what comes out of the conference.
Meanwhile, worth mentioning today that Christina Fey is going to be sentenced today. She was found guilty of 17 misdemeanor counts a couple of months ago related to her treatment of dozens of Great Danes in Wolfboro in her Wolfboro mansion. Worth mentioning that these animals have very short lifespans, right? Like 5 to 7 years for Great Danes.
Yep, 5 to 8. Yep.
And they've spent a considerable percentage of it now in sort of temporary care as they wait for this to happen. So that's part of the argument lawyers are making, which is that, you know, these animals, they have short lifespans and they're spending too much of it in this temporary care. So that's the animal cruelty bill. Let's talk about a bill that started as a bill to create a state demographer position and now has something like $94 million worth of spending attached to it. It makes sense when you unpack it, right, Paul, Trent? Yes.
It makes sense when you unpack it. Yes.
So how did this bill evolve from a state demographer to $94 million in spending?
So additional revenue came in and Republicans in the Senate said we should invest this money. And so it would pay about $13 million for state workers for pay raises, $20 million in bridge repairs, $10 million going to go into the state rainy day fund. I think something like $36 million will be going into this separate fund that will could potentially be used to resolve a lawsuit among the state hospitals. What Republicans said was, we want to use this on one-time things, right? We don't want to create new programs. We have all this money. We don't want to create new programs. We're worried if we lose control of the House and the Senate that Democrats would want to expand whatever new program we are using. So instead, let's fix some bridges. Let's set aside money in case we lose this lawsuit against the hospitals. Let's pay for these state worker raises that the governor negotiated. And let's just do one. Let's take it's about $100 million. Let's take all this money, use it on one-time things, get it out of the state coffers. They've gotten a lot of negative feedback about that from fiscal conservatives, from policymakers in Concord, that this money should not have been spent like this. It was very late in the process. It's a lot of money, and some people are calling it its own little mini budget. So I think this is all going to go through, but I think that Republicans who supported this are going to catch some flack over it.
Okay. Let's talk about Steve Marchand, the Democratic gubernatorial candidate, former mayor of Portsmouth. He released a plan for a public campaign financing system. Paul, what do you make of the system that he's proposing?
He wants to get big bucks out of New Hampshire politics. You know, we spent a lot of time in this state. This is the state of Granny D, right? This is the state we've talked a lot about national campaign finance reform. But this is state finance reform. And let's be honest, some of the laws here in New Hampshire are some of the more confusing and maybe least scrutinized and least enforced in the nation. What he wants to do, and he had announced his plan, he would incentivize candidates for governor, executive council, and the state senate to raise money from small dollar in-state donors rather than from wealthy out-of-state contributors and lobbyists, corporations, political action committees. If you do all that and follow all his rules, then you'll get matching funds from the state. And this will, he would hope, incentivize, again, politicians to go for the small dollar donations in-state rather than the big bucks out-of-state. There's some opposition to this, obviously, especially from Republicans who say, wait a minute, now you want state money? This is, how much is this going to cost the state? Is this a good idea? Molly Kelly, the other Democrat running for governor, there are two now, she supports campaign finance reform. She hasn't specifically said whether she supports this plan, but overall she supports the idea of campaign finance reform.
Dean? Yeah, the problem is we've had public financing at the federal level for many years, and it essentially has been blown up starting in the early 2000s, in which anybody who could raise enough money, President Obama, George W. Bush, decided to forego the restraints on fundraising. So, you know, this is going to be a mandatory system. It's going to run into constitutional challenges because the courts have consistently argued that money equals speech. So that's one problem. If it's voluntary, then any candidate who has the ability to raise more money will do that because money equals a sign of viability under the current system. So it's kind of conceptually, this is something progressives like to think about conceptually, but it's fallen apart at the federal level for any candidate with serious viability. And my guess is it would be very difficult to work at the state level.
It would be, and he'd probably need, if he became governor, he would need a very large Democratic majority in the state Senate and state House to get this accomplished, to get this even passed.
Right.
But you mentioned there's campaign politics here. Listen, right now, Steve Marchand and Molly Kelly are running for the Democratic nomination for governor in the state. Where's all the energy right now on the Democratic side? With the progressives, that's where the energy is. Progressives like this issue. It's a good issue if you're looking for Democratic primary votes.
It's got real workability problems.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll talk a little bit more about Steve Marchand right after the break. We'll also talk about a poll that shows Governor Sununu is doing pretty well in among Granite Staters. President Trump not doing as well. Of course, we'll also talk about the report issued by the Disability Rights Center of New Hampshire accusing the Sununu Youth Services Center of using improper restraint on a 14-year-old boy that broke his shoulder blade. We'll talk about that and about the response from the state's child advocate. Give us a call if you have questions or comments about the week's news. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email us exchange@nhpr.org or check out our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Dear Nick in Bennington.
Diane in Littleton.
Susan in Portsmouth.
Cindy in
Carlos in Colton.
You are my favorite NHPR listener.
Because you inspire the work I do every day.
You're passionate about the outdoors, so we created Outside In.
You're curious about your community, so we hired more regional reporters.
We're engaged in politics, so we invested in NHPR's State of Democracy.
Because you inspire, we innovate.
Learn more about NHPR's campaign for innovation at nhprinnovation.org. Yours truly,
Robert.
Casey,
Sam,
Rita,
Hannah,
Lauren,
Jason.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and the author of the website NH Political Capital, Paul Steinhauser, political reporter, and Trent Spinner of The Union Leader. And with you, give us a call to join the conversation. The number is 1-800-892-6477. We have a few more stories about the week's news to discuss this week, but we also were talking about Democratic gubernatorial candidate Steve Marchand before the break. Steve Marchand actually gave us a call. He's on the line with us now. Steve Marchand, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Hey, thank you for having me on for a moment.
You were interested in clarifying a remark made about your campaign finance plan.
Yes. Well, first of all, I happen to be in the car, so I'm a fan of the show. So I happened to hear it, and I did hear a few things that I think were important I just want to put on the table.
Certainly.
So one is, in terms of the difference between my position on campaign finance and that of both Chris and Molly, to be clear, both have said flat out that they oppose the use of any taxpayer funds for public financing of elections, which is really the core of the plan. So it's a pretty significant difference, and it really gets at what I think other states have found. The 12 states that have some form of campaign finance reform like this have found that unless you do some kind of public match or public funding, it's pretty difficult for it to be effective at the voluntary level even. So that's the real nub of it. And I think I'm the first candidate in at least a generation that's saying flat out that you have to do something like that if you want to fix a system that I think is fundamentally broken.
And with respect to the system you're proposing, Steve Marchand, it was said here not too long ago that it's going to require, or it may require, Democratic majorities in both the House and the Senate in New Hampshire. Do you think that's the case, or do you think you can convince a bipartisan group of lawmakers to pass this through?
Well, here's what I think. One of the differences between myself and others running for governor is I'm running for the job, and that means that from day one you're really running with a message and a style that is built to earn majorities in the House and Senate because of the clarity and the boldness of the message. So I do agree it would be much more likely to occur with a Democratic majority in the legislature, and I think that we can get that this fall for a lot of reasons, national as well as what we're doing at the state level. But I also know that in the states that have public funding as part of their campaign finance plan, even when Republicans have majorities in one or both chambers, they find it very difficult to undo it once it is law because it is popular. And I would say the reason why some people oppose it, including my opponents in this race, is because they're afraid it'll work, because it does work. In Connecticut, which this system is based off of, about 80% of candidates end up using the voluntary system, and it works. And it means that you spend most of your time not raising money, and definitely not on the phone raising money from big money people or out-of-state people. You get to that point sooner, it's almost entirely in-state, and then you spend much more of your time campaigning with people, which is what everybody says they want us all to do. But I'm actually the one candidate that's trying to do something so we can actually do that thing.
Steve Marchand, Democratic candidate for governor, former mayor of Portsmouth, thank you very much for calling in.
I appreciate it. Thank you guys very much.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. Before we move on to the next topic, any comments on what Steve Marchand just had to say?
That's the beautiful part of covering politics in New Hampshire.
They call in when we're talking about
it. I think Molly Kelly would probably would differ on where she stands. She's also said publicly to me and to others, you know, she wants to get dark money out of politics. We'll have to have her weigh in on this issue specifically. The governor obviously would not agree with this plan at all.
There was a poll this week that we should talk about. I think it was the St. A's poll mm-hmm. that shows that Governor Chris Sununu has a relatively high approval rating. President Trump among Granite Staters, slightly better than the last poll, but still not great. So a disparity there.
It's great having St. A's polling because, you know, we've always had UNH's polls, Suffolk University down in Boston. They poll up here. They do polls. So it's great to have St. A's. Now we have three live operator nonpartisan polls in the state, which is great. The more the merrier. Yeah, let's start with Sununu. 65% approval in the latest poll, up from 57% back in the St. A's poll back in February. 65 is about as high as he's been. He's been mostly in the upper 50s to low 60s. These are some pretty nice numbers for a governor who's just 6 months out from his reelection. Donald Trump, the president, still underwater in the state, but better at 41% approval, 57% disapproval, which, that's not good, but it's a heck of a lot better than it was in February. The other number that I thought stood out was Annie Custer in the 2nd District. Her approval rating is slightly above water. Remember, she's the Democrat, the 3-term Democrat running for a 4th term. But they also asked another question, does she deserve to be reelected? And on that number, she is underwater. More people said, we think we should have somebody new rather than, yes, she's doing a good enough job to be reelected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, so much of this is going to really depend on the size of a potential Democratic wave, the difference between Democratic and Republican turnout, and the extent to which independents stay with or abandon Governor Sununu. You know, I think it's important for Democrats to have a vigorous primary debate between Marchand and Kelly, and I think that's good for the party. But the reality is, Governor Sununu, by all the standard metrics, is pretty well positioned to win re-election. That said, if it's a big enough wave, he may be washed out with other Republicans, or he may be the last Republican standing, a la John Lynch in 2010, when he was the only Democrat pretty much after the Tea Party rebellion. So, you know, whether the Democratic nominee is Steve Marchand or Molly Kelly, so much of this is going to be driven, as it typically is with House congressional races in the House, by the larger dynamics of the anti-Trump backlash. If it's only sort of a moderate backlash, I think Sununu is in pretty good shape, regardless of who the Democratic nominee is. If it's a big wave, he may be hanging on by fingertips.
No surprise here, but this poll, like the others, like the UNH poll and the Suffolk poll, indicate also that, you know, people just don't know who Kelly and Marchand are right now. Their name recognition is very low. It's the same for the Republicans running against Custer in the 2nd congressional district, and the Democrats and Republicans, 12 of them now, in the 1st district. There's no name recognition right now. That will change as we get closer to the primary in September and the general election.
Trent? To that point, I don't think anyone's paying attention to politics.
We're
the only ones. And you listening, thank you so much. But, you know, I was at a Derby party the other weekend, and not one single person asked about politics. But leading up to 2016, right, to that campaign, that's all people could talk about. I really don't think people are paying attention right now. So when I look at polls, St. Anselm College did a fantastic job with this poll. But when I look at polls this early in April and May, even all the way until September, really, I don't think that people care enough to understand who they're going to vote for. What I do find interesting in this poll was when people do some current events polling, and what they did here was, I thought, fascinating. They asked everybody, what do you think about James Comey? Do you think that his book is shedding light on important matters concerning the Trump administration, or is he just furthering his own personal agenda? This was the most surprising thing about this poll. The result was that 50% of people said that he was just acting to further his personal agenda. Less than 30% of people said that he published the book to shed light on important matters. So when I look at polls like this, I'm always looking to see what kind of current events things are happening there. And it was fascinating to me to see how many people did not give credit to James Comey.
Well, it's interesting because those two options don't seem mutually exclusively to me. Like, you can do both, right? You can further your agenda and put out important information.
That's a good point. That's a great point. Yeah.
Worth talking about this week, an important report from the Disability Rights Center says employees at the Sununu Youth Services Center there's reason to believe that they routinely use improper restraint on those in its charge. This was discovered after an investigation into an incident that left a 14-year-old boy with a broken shoulder blade back in 2016. Apparently, this boy, who they're calling Zach, was trying to talk to someone outside his room. There was a scuffle of some kind, and DRC staff attorney Andrew Milne described part of what happened.
Staff immediately dropped him to the floor face down, and one of the staff members landed on Zach's back, which is what the medical examiner concluded was probably the cause of the fracture to Zach's shoulder blade.
So a significant injury to Zach. They're not disputing that, but the DRC is saying that it is an unlawful use of the restraint based on definitions of how they can use restraint. Maura O'Neill, the state's new child advocate, says both DHHS and the AG have known about this incident for some time, although when this report was released, the attorney general says they're going to look into it again. DHHS said they're going to cooperate. But Maura O'Neill said, DHHS did complete an internal review of this incident in October of last year.
So quite frankly, it's interesting that we're saying that we're waiting for the Attorney General and the DCYF to investigate, because they already have. So I'd be curious to know what they're now investigating again.
NHPR's Jason Moon spoke with her this week. O'Neill says her office is beginning its own investigation into the use of restraints at the Sununu Youth Services Center.
We'll be looking at who works there, what their credentials are, what their training has been, how often they're trained and retrained. We'll be looking at videotape as well to see what's been going on there.
Trent, what do you make of the story?
This is an important story and that's something that we will be following. The Sununu Youth Services Center was originally built to house teenagers, 13 to 17, people who were in the criminal justice system who had committed some kind of crime. It recently is now being used also to house people in that same age group who are having mental health issues, who maybe did not commit a crime, but there's just nowhere else for them to go. And so the state has a responsibility here to make sure that these people are being, that these teenagers are being cared for, that they're being treated safely. And so this is going to be a political football because there's not a ton of funding for this. There's not it's a difficult situation. It's also difficult for us to report on because a lot of this is private. You cannot get information about incidents that happen there. You can't really dig into it. And so the public has a difficult time of understanding what is going on there, which creates a kind of a lack of political support among people in Concord to do something about it. So it's kind of challenging all the way around.
A few more stories to discuss before the end of the show today. One is that the National Association of Wine Retailers says the New Hampshire Liquor Commission is using, quote, gangster tactics to eliminate competition from the brick-and-mortar wine retailers. So leaving aside the question of whether or not these are gangster tactics, what is the Liquor Commission doing that has the National Association of Wine Retailers so upset?
Yeah, people were this. I mean, this has been fermenting for a while, and it finally bubbled over.
Yeah, well said. Thank you. Thank you for that.
He practiced that line for hours, and he delivered it very well.
Union leaders winning the award for puns this week. We'll get to another one, but anyway.
So the deal. Here's the deal. New Hampshire was one of only 10 states in the country that would allow outside distributors to ship directly to you. So if you wanted to go to a website, you know, whatever, wine.com, and buy some wine that you really love, you're allowed to do that in New Hampshire. The idea was, hey, we're live free or die. It was a kind of a growing economic thing that the Liquor Commission wanted to support when it was first starting. Here's their argument now, is that regular brick and mortar retailers have created their own websites, and they are now competing directly with the state liquor stores. They went to the legislature and asked for a law that would essentially allow them to regulate this. That was not passed. And in exchange, what the Liquor Commission did was they said, look, we already have the right to regulate any kind of liquor sales, liquor or wine sales that could potentially infringe on our business. And so rather than getting that direct specific law that they wanted, which did not pass, they used another part of state law to basically shut this down for, I think it's like 80. So these are brick and mortar retailers who also have a website and are now trying to ship into New Hampshire, basically to get around the state monopoly on sales. And so they're saying, rather than using this new law, we're going to instead find this other piece of legislation that we can use. And so that's why the retailers are upset, because they had never used it in the past. They say that it's gangster tactics because they didn't go through the full House and Senate process. But if you read the law, it's pretty clear. It says that they have the right to regulate this type of work.
This doesn't affect wine clubs and wineries and things like that. It's these retailers that they're competing with and concerned about losing revenue.
Yeah, and the state says it has its right to protect its source of revenue. We'll probably hear more about this story in the weeks to come. But we have to put Trent on the spot here for this headline that was in the Union Leader. They were guano, but now they're back. Trent, explain yourself on this.
I cannot take credit for this. We have an incredible night team at the New Hampshire Union Leader, led by Sherry Wood, who was part of a Pulitzer-winning team for breaking news, and our design editor, Tom Lynch. This was Tom's idea.
It made me read the story, so it worked.
It worked, yes. Tom has a great sense of humor. This is about a $600,000 cleanup at a Merrimack Elementary School. They spent all this money to get rid of these bats and the guano that came with them. It didn't work. There were two more bats just found in the school this week. It was a great headline. Credit to Tom Lynch.
Yep, $600,000 to clean it up. $180,000 came from the state, so it must be pretty heartbreaking to see. Oh boy, they're back.
Right.
We like to end the show with animal stories, so we've got two this week. The other one is that there was a bear in a tree in Manchester this week. That was early in the week, but apparently we've seen more bears going perhaps where they shouldn't in New Hampshire. But bear in a tree in Manchester.
bear in a tree in Manchester. That's a great way to wake up on Monday morning. It was, I don't know what was more of a circus, the bear in the tree or the media covering the bear in the tree. There were Boston helicopters flying over it. There were all kinds of people. And this was like right behind CMC. So it was in a pretty well-populated spot.
Slow motion shots of the bear being shot with the tranquilizer and then kind of falling asleep and then falling out of the tree.
Being caught in a net, being taken up to the lakes region. What a wild story.
But the bear apparently is okay now.
This happens all the time. Yep. And Fish and Game are prepared to do this. They have a whole system that they use. It was cool to be able to watch it. Our reporter spent, I think, 3 or 4 hours there.
Well, time well spent, because I'm sure it got a lot of eyeballs on web traffic.
That's
so
right.
That's good. Well, let's talk about what's happening next week. Paul, what are you going to be covering next week?
Let's start with this weekend. We've got four Democratic presidential potential contenders in the state this weekend. I just wrote about it for Fox News, actually. The traffic is way up from 4 years ago when Democrats really weren't making the trek up here because, well, Hillary Clinton was going to run for president, and she ended up doing that. So I'll be covering John Delaney tonight in Manchester at the Puritan. Tomorrow we've got Julian Castro, the former HUD secretary. He'll be giving the commencement speech at New England College. We've also got Jason Kander, the former Missouri Secretary of State, back in the state this weekend. And Eric Garcetti, the L.A. mayor, on Sunday will be giving the commencement address at Southern New Hampshire University.
How about you, Trent?
I'm really looking forward to the launch of our new series, Beyond the Stigma, which is going to premiere in the Sunday News this week. This is a year-long series that we're working on that looks at the opioid and mental health crises in New Hampshire, led by Sean Wickham. She's going to be looking at programs that support pregnant women who are struggling with substance abuse. This is going to be the first of the series. It's a year-long Beyond the Stigma. It's going to be in the New Hampshire Sunday News.
Great. And how about you, Dean? What will you be following?
State legislature wrapping up, but also I'm interested in these presidential visits. You know, Kander and Delaney have been around a lot. Garcetti and Castro, not as much. And I think there's some interest to see. Those are sort of two pretty well-known individuals, what they're going to be up to in the state.
All right. Well, Dean Spiliotis, Paul Steinhauser, Trent Spinner, thank you very much for being on the show today.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks.
And listeners, a reminder that our Race for the First series continues on Monday with candidate Lincoln Soldati. You can listen on Monday for that and check out all the past interviews in our Race for the First series at nhpr.org or by subscribing to the Exchange podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Remember, the conversation continues online about these stories. You can find links to all the stories we discussed today at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips, and our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.